Next speaker is Dr. Stephen Satson. Dr. Satson is from Reno Research Institute, New York, and his title of the presentation is quite intriguing. It's The Surprising Question.
Thank you very much. Thanks a lot. Well, good morning, everybody. My name's actually pronounced Tyson. I know it's a very weird name. No, that's all right. It's not Tyler either. It's really funny. Earlier this morning, I got to just tell you real quick, Dr. Topf came up to me and he said, he caught a brief glimpse of my name tag and he said, oh, are you related to Steven Tyler from Aerosmith? And I said, no, if I were, I'd be at a beach right now sipping a Mai Tai, so I'm not related to him. So some of you may have noticed also that I'm not Dr. Joshi, who was on this particular time slot up until a couple of days ago. And the reason for that is that Dr. Toshi had to cancel on us at the very last minute. Unfortunately, these things happen. But you're probably only marginally more surprised about this than I am because I learned about it short notice as well. So we're in this together. But that's quite all right because I brought a topic for you that I think is very interesting. And I hope you agree with that. And I hope it'll create some value. So let me just grab some water. I talked a lot yesterday. Actually, before we get into the presentation, I just got to tell you this story real quick. And some of you may have heard of this because this is a true story. It happened a couple years ago in Manhattan. So there was this married couple, both of them 50 years old. They had actually been married for quite a long time already at that time, and happily too, I should say, or at least so they thought. In any event, so they were strolling through Central Park one Sunday afternoon, and then all of a sudden they saw this lamb sitting there in the grass. It was a little bit hidden. And it looked like one of those, you know, magic, you know, those genie-type lamps, if you know the type that I'm talking about. So the husband went there, he picked it up, and he rubs the lamp, and a genie comes out. And, you know, sure enough, did I mention this is a true story, so pay attention. So he picked up the lamp, the genie comes out and says, well, thank you so much for getting me out of this lamp. I really appreciate it. As a token of my appreciation, you know, each of you gets one wish. And she turns to the wife and says, so what can I do for you? And the wife says, you know, in these 50 years that I've spent on this rock floating around the sun, I've always really wanted to go on a nice cruise, on a cruise ship. I've never really had the opportunity. So that would be fantastic if that's not too much to ask. And the genie says, too much to ask? That's easy. You know, and she takes her magic wand and she goes, poof. And then right just like that, she's holding two nice tickets for a cruise around the world and a cruise ship. She's all excited. And then the genie turns to the husband and says, so what's it going to be for you, sir? And the husband says, well, and he's a little hesitant, you know, almost ashamed. And then he looks at his wife, and he looks at the genie, and then he says, anything really? And the genie says, yeah, of course, anything. You know, just name it, I'll take care of it. And so he says, well, and, you know, he's still hesitant, but then he's thinking, okay, this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. Might as well take it. And he says, here's my wish. I don't want to seem selfish or anything, but could you make my wife 30 years younger than me, please? And the genie says, yeah, absolutely, not a problem, you know. Takes out her magic wand, and she goes, poof. And then just like that, the husband was suddenly 80 years old, right? And why am I telling that story? Is because it relates to what we're talking about today. I would argue if you're asking something, you probably want to think about it and make sure that you are getting what you think you're getting. And that's certainly true for genies, because they always tend to trick you that way in my experience. But even for something as seemingly simple as a surprise question, which we're going to talk about today, that can be an issue, and that's what I want to spend a half an hour talking about real quick with you. So the surprise question, you get what you ask for, indeed. First of all, what is the surprise question? The surprise question is not where's Dr. Joshi, although you might be wondering that right now, but the surprise question is when you go out to a member of the healthcare team and you ask them about a specific patient, you know, would you be surprised if your patient was still alive in 12 months or in 6 months? You know, there's different variants of that question. Or you could ask it the other way around. You could say, would you be surprised if your patient was no longer alive in 12 months or in 6 months? So that particular question in recent years has gained quite a bit of interest in the end-stage renal disease population. And the reason for that is, not to spoil the surprise, but I'll just mention it right up front, typically what you find is that the surprise question is actually a significant independent predictor of mortality in our population. So, that being the case, the question that comes up is, does this mean we should be using this to predict outcomes? You know, risk stratification, something of that nature. I mean, after all, it appears to be working. Well, actually, at this point, I had included a whole bunch of slides where I'm going over what the various findings are in the literature. But then it struck me as, I don't want to say boring, but you probably want to, you know, don't want to hear me regurgitate what's in the literature, because you can probably just go to PubMed and type in surprise question, hemodialysis, and within 30 minutes you get a good idea. So I figured that instead what I want to do today, I mean, I'll tell you a little bit about what's typically found in the literature, but then I want to move on and instead give you something that perhaps you can't find that easily on PubMed, which is my own original thoughts on the surprise question, and I hope that, you know, that creates some value. But I asked myself, if I could only mention three things about the surprise question, what would that be? I would summarize it like this. Typically, what you find in the literature is that the sensitivity is rather low, somewhere around 35, 40, 50%-ish, somewhere in that ballpark. Specificity is typically higher, you know, something around 80%-ish. It varies depending on who you ask, but something of that nature. Secondly, I would say there is massive variability between clinicians. So some of them are very good at this, some of them are not so good at this. So these numbers that I just quoted there, they're averages, but the range is massive. And, you know, I think during my presentation you'll get a sense of why that might be. The most important point, though, is this one. That all being the case, still, typically what you find is that the surprise question responses are a significant independent predictor of mortality. So, back to the question, should we use the surprise question for mortality prediction? Now, instead of answering that right now, let me pose a different question and say, how does the surprise question actually stack up to a sophisticated statistical prediction model? And you may be wondering, you know, I'm not aware that such a study has been published, and you may be right, except that we've actually done such a study, and it's literally, I want to say, 95% written up, and that'll be out very soon, hopefully. But I'll give you a sneak peek of what we found. So here's what we did. We generated, generalized linear models, GLMs, for both 6 and 12-month mortality prediction. And we did this in chronic dialysis patients from Fresenius here in the U.S., took a one-year baseline period. We took that whole cohort of patients and split it right down the middle. We used one half to generate those models, and the other half, the other 50%, for validating the models to see how they perform. So that's what we would call the validation cohort. Now, predictor variables, you know, came from a wide, you know, range of domains, all the way from demographics, anthropometrics, clinical data, laboratory data, dialysis treatment data. You'll see on the next slide what I mean by that. At the same time, what we also did is we went out to 33 nephrologists from 8 RI clinics covering almost 900 patients, and we asked them to answer the surprise question for us, 6 and 12-month surprise question, and then we tracked those patients prospectively for 12 months, and we recorded their outcomes, and we then compared it to what the physician said to see how they performed. Now, actually, in the interest of time, I'll skip over a lot of this. I'll just mention two things real quick. Here's what I meant with there were a lot of predictors. So this is not your typical, you know, model that you might see where you've got age, gender, race, and albumin in there. We ended up having 49 predictors for the 6-month model and 47 for the 12-month model, so quite a lot then. And let me just mention, for those of you who are not familiar perhaps with this, you can do such a model in principle with two intentions in mind. You could be doing a model like this because you want to draw inferences about the relationship between these predictors that you have in there and the outcome of interest. And in that case, obviously, you would be interested in whether or not that relationship is significant, statistically speaking. However, you can also generate a model with the sole intention of making predictions, which is what we're doing here. And if that's the case, you're not really concerned with whether or not that's a significant predictor. It doesn't have to be significant. If it improves the predictive quality of the model, it's in. So you can end up with a lot of, not all of these parameters were necessarily significant, is what I'm trying to say. Now, what was a little bit disappointing is we only got surprise question responses back from 10 physicians from 5 clinics, but, you know, still, that was a little underwhelming, but we were able to cover slightly more than 200 patients, so that was better than nothing. And here's what we found. If you look at the surprise question, how did it perform? If you just focus on the bottom panel right here, this is the 12-month surprise question. You'll see sensitivity, you know, this is for the average physician there, sensitivity was 35% and a specificity of 88% roughly. remember the numbers I showed you earlier. This is very typical for what you would find, you know, what you also find in other studies in the literature. For a six-month prediction, similar pattern, slightly lower sensitivity, slightly higher specificity. Now, how does that compare to the prediction models? And what I'm showing here are the areas under the ROC curves for, you know, the 6 and the 12-month prediction for the various cohorts. And you can see that they're all in the same ballpark. They're all around 80%-ish. And in case you're wondering how such a number relates to anything up here, let me try and illustrate that a little bit on the next slide. Now, actually, Dr. Agarwal already mentioned ROC analysis earlier. I'm not sure how, you know, how many of you are intimately familiar with ROC curves, but maybe I'll spend a minute or two talking about what you're actually seeing there, just in case. So, if you have a test that gives you a, you know, an output on as a continuous variable, whether that's an antibody titer or an enzyme activity or a, you know, or in our case for the prediction models, what do they give you? They give you a probability of death, which can range anywhere from 0% to 100%. So, if you have such a test and you want to translate it into a binary outcome, meaning is that a positive test or a negative test, you're going to have to define a threshold. So let's say for Mr. Smith, the model comes back and says the probability of death for in the next 12 months is going to be 27%. Well, is that a positive test? Now, it depends. If your threshold is at 10% and anything above that you're going to call a positive test, then it's a positive test. If the threshold is 40%, well, no, then it's still a negative test. Now, what the ROC analysis does is it goes in and it implements each and every single one of those possible thresholds. And then for each one of them, it calculates a sensitivity and a specificity. And then it takes all these sensitivity specificity pairs and it plots them into this nice diagram where you've got the sensitivity over here and the specificity down here. And you end up with a curve like this. And by the way, so if you apply our models to the validation cohort, you get this nice, you know, I don't know if you can see, probably can't see it, it's a dotted line, this nice smooth curve here. So when you apply it to the surprise question cohort, which is these 200-something patients, you get this jagged line here. And the reason it looks so jagged is because it's fewer patients, obviously, so it's not as smooth. But you see they have about the same area under the curve. This is for 6-month prediction, this is for 12-month prediction. So now, then what you want to do is you want to look at the area under that curve, and why? Because if you have a test that is useless, you know, that has absolutely no predictive predictive power, that such a test would be showing a curve that lies right here on this diagonal. So what's the area under the diagonal here? Well, that's half of that square, so it's a 50% area under the curve. That's a useless test. The greater the area under the curve, the better, generally speaking, the test is. Now, these are, and I've shown you this on the previous slide, these are around 80% area under the curve, which is not a bad number. Now, the physicians, on the other hand, for a physician, you don't get a curve because they just give you their surprise question responses, yes, no, yes, yes, no. You compare that to the actual outcomes of the patients, and you can calculate a sensitivity and a specificity, but you can't vary any thresholds or anything. So you just get one spot on that graph for each physician. And the physicians, where are they? Well, these are all these colorful circles that you see. And you'll see that some of them are above our curves, meaning that particular physician did better than our models, and quite a number of them are below our curves. There are quite a few down here, actually. So when you aggregate them all together, by the way, this illustrates the huge variability that I was talking about earlier. Some people are just better at this and some are worse at this. It depends on a whole number of factors. But if you aggregate them all together and see how does the average physician perform, that's what the little red dot symbolizes right here, and the other one is right here. You'll see this one is right on that jagged curve, meaning the model and the physicians perform equally well in that case. However, here you'll see that the red dot is actually quite a bit below that jagged curve, meaning the model performed quite a bit better. And there's a bunch of other things in there that I'm not going to mention now, but let me just skip over these things because I just told you all that. In case you're still wondering, how do you even compare one, you know, point, like for the average physician, how do you compare that to the curve? Because obviously for the model, you can vary your threshold and end up with any, you know, combination of sensitivity and specificity. What's a fair comparison? What we did is We looked at the sensitivity and the specificity of the physicians, which are what they are. In this case, they were 35% sensitivity and an 88% specificity. Okay, I'm looking at the 12-month prediction here. And then we varied the threshold for that model test, if you will, to produce the same exact sensitivity that the physicians achieved. And so we basically fixed this part here, and we said, okay, now that that's done, we can jump over here and see, that being the same, how do the specificities compare? And you'll see that the model with the specificity of 98% versus just 88% for the physicians performed better for the same sensitivity threshold. Now, conversely, you might also want to go in and fix this part and say, let's keep the specificity of the model the same as the one that the physicians produce, and then compare the sensitivities. Now, you'll see that either way you look at it, the model performs better. In this case, sensitivity of the model is actually almost twice as high as the physicians for this particular, version of that test, if you will, with those thresholds. We think that's at least a meaningful comparison between the two. So, back to the question, should the surprise question be used for mortality prediction? Now, and this is going back to the silly joke I was telling in the beginning, you may not be getting what you think you're getting. What I mean by that is, just imagine you were asking a bunch of people, and you were saying, expressed as a percentage, how much would you say is often? You know, how much is sometimes? How much is usually? How much is seldom? You would be surprised at the answers that you get. They're literally all over the map. And I know this because we've done that just a couple years ago. It had nothing to do with the surprise questions. It's a completely separate reason we did this. But we gathered our staff and we asked them these types of questions all over the map, you know. And, I mean, quite literally, we had one person in there, just to tell you this as an illustration. We asked everybody the question, how much would you say, as a percentage, how much is always? Now, this is a scientific conference, and I hope we could probably all agree that always means 100% of the time. Unless maybe I need to define what I mean by all. But so, 100%. But what the person wrote down was 80%. And we thought he made a joke or he made a mistake, and we asked him about it afterwards. He said, no, that's my story, and I'm sticking with it. Because, look, nothing in life is ever really 100%. Right? Let's not be holier than the Pope. I mean, if something's 80%, to me, that qualifies as always. And he was not joking or trying to get attention. That was his honest answer. So this varies a lot. People, you know, interpret these questions differently depending on the context. What can you learn from that? Okay, so what you can learn from this is, well, two things, actually. So one is that the guy no longer works for us. I think that goes without saying. The other thing is that language is just inherently, you know, ambiguous like that. So what do you think happens when you ask somebody a question like, would you be surprised if the patient died in the next 12 months? So in their head, they're going to have to be doing something like this. First, they ask themselves, wait a minute, what do I think is the probability that that patient will die? And let's say they come up with a number, heaven knows how they do it, just magically, there it is, 5%. Then they have to ask themselves, no, given that it's 5%, do I think that's a high probability or not? And I don't know what you're going to base that on. It's probably different for everybody. Let's say they come up and say, you know, not really. Maybe they're basing it off of the average mortality rate in the clinic, and they say, 5% is not all that high, maybe. So then they have to say, okay, now, that being the case, I've just established that it's not a high probability. Now, what if the patient still died, despite that being a low probability? Then would I be surprised? Yeah, absolutely. Then I guess I would be surprised. But I hope you can see that at every single step of that chain, there's huge variability that comes into this. So, you know, you ask the next person about the same exact patient, and they're going to come back with 20%. You know, it could be anything. Or even if they come up with 5%, is it, you know, does it stand to reason that somebody else might say, yeah, I think it's 5%, but I think that's a high probability? Because maybe they're basing it off of something else and not the average mortality in the clinic. Maybe they're saying, well, this is Mr. Smith, not just an average patient. And for Mr. Smith, I always, you know, I saw him around 1% to 2%. You know, I had high expectations there, but now the situation's changed. Now I'm going to have to put him at 5%, and I think for him, that's a high probability. All of a sudden, you get a different answer. Or even at that last point, do you think it's conceivable that somebody says, I put it at 5%, I think that's not really high. I'll even go as far as to say, I think the patient will not die in the next 12 months. But If the patient still died, would I be surprised? Absolutely not. I've been in this business for 20 years. I've seen stranger things happen than that. You know, I wouldn't be surprised. You know, anything's possible. So you really don't know what you're getting. I mean, if you want to know, do you think the patient's going to die in the next 12 months, why don't you just ask that? But if you ask in that roundabout way, you know, that introduces a lot of variability into this. And I think that shows in the numbers that you see in the literature when it comes to the huge variability in sensitivity and specificity. Now, at this point, you're probably wondering, okay, you're not a fan of the surprise question, but let me ask you this question. Would it make sense? You've just explained to us that you can throw, you know, everything in the kitchen sink at such a model. As long as it improves the predictive power, it's a welcome predictor. It doesn't even have to be significant. Now, with the surprise question, we already know that it's a significant independent predictor of mortality. So wouldn't it make sense then to take that and just add it into the model as yet another parameter and thereby make the model just that little bit better? And, I'll try and answer that question by asking you a question in return. Which dialogue do you think is more valuable? This one, where the physician says, you know, I think the patient's not going to make it much longer. And then the model says, yeah, I agree. And the physician says, yeah, I knew it. Or perhaps this dialogue. I think the patient is not going to make it much longer. The model says, well, you're the doc, and I don't know, I mean, I don't know Mr. Smith the way you know Mr. Smith, and I can't talk about Mr. Smith, but what I can tell you is, based on everything that I've looked at, somebody who looks just like Mr. Smith typically doesn't die in the next 6 months, just so you know, but whatever you say. And then you're wondering, wait a minute, what's going on? Am I missing something, perhaps? Right? Or this dialogue, just the other way around. I think the patient's doing just fine. Yeah, I agree. I knew it. Or, I think the patient's doing quite all right. Well, really, I don't know that particular patient, but based on what I can see, that patient has a really high chance of dying in the next 6 months. Everybody else who looks just like that patient typically does. And then you're wondering, wait a minute, what am I missing? So, that being the case, should we add the surprise question as a predictor to the model? In my personal opinion, the answer is absolutely not. Now, we already know that the surprise question is a significant independent predictor of mortality. And what that means is that if you add that into the model, using the physician's opinion, essentially, as a predictor in the model, can really heavily sway the prediction of that model one way or the other. And I would argue that's a really bad idea. What you want to probably do is you want to preserve that, you know, cognitive dissonance, or if that's even the right word, maybe, the potential disagreement, essentially, between the physician and the model. You want to preserve that at all costs, because I think that discrepancy is precisely where a lot of the value creation really happens. And also, that discrepancy may just allow you to focus your attention and channel it to those patients who stand to benefit the most. Because let's be honest, I mean, you cannot focus 100% of your attention to everybody all the time. You have to channel it. And this might just be one tool that allows you to make a rational decision about where you should perhaps be paying attention more or where you might be paying attention a little bit less if you have to make that decision. So, I would encourage us to look at these types of models as sort of external independent validation tools or benchmarks, if you will, against which you can then compare your own assessment and see how it stacks up. And if you agree, that's wonderful. If you don't, that might just be that little bit of disagreement that's necessary to take a second look, and that might actually channel your attention and create some value, I would argue. Now, what's it going to be, the surprise question or the prediction model? My hope would be that the next time somebody asks you and says, hey, did you know that the surprise question is a significant independent predictor of mortality in end-stage renal disease patients, that you're going to say, well, first of all, yes, of course I knew that, everybody knows that, but did you know that a sophisticated, good prediction model can actually yield the same or perhaps even a better prediction quality than you can get with the surprise question? And you may want to follow that up by saying, and did you also know that prediction models have quite a bunch of other advantages over the surprise question as well? And if they say, yeah, like what? Then maybe you want to follow it up with, This is my killer slide. Everything in one table here. The first one we've already talked about, so we can skip over this one. The models give you at least the same, if not a better, predictive power. But how about some of the other advantages? Well, the surprise question gives you a binary output, yes or no. That's inherently less information than you get with the model. The model gives you a death probability. I mean, would you like to know if the test comes back positive because the chance of death are, you know, is 20% or 95%? Would that matter to you? I think it makes a difference. So with the model, you get that additional information. It's more granular. What's more is, with the surprise question, you can't choose a cutoff like you can with the model. You just ask the question, you get your answers, and it is what it is, and you're just going to have to live with it. With the model, on the other hand, you can vary the cutoff and base it off of the application. You can adapt it to whatever situation you want to use it in. You know, I would argue there's at least two broad categories of goals why you want to ask that question in the first place, the surprise question, that is. One would be to identify patients who are on a trajectory towards death, but there's still something you can do about it. You want to, they have a modifiable risk, perhaps. You want to step in there, intervene, do something about it, hopefully change that trajectory. On the other hand, you may want to just use it to identify patients who are on an irreversible trajectory towards death so you can institute proper end-of-life care. Now, arguably, two very, very different scenarios, which I would say require different tools to get the job done. And this is, you know, similar to, for example, HIV tests, where you're doing a screening test and you follow that up with a confirmatory test. And the characteristics of a screening test are that it has a very high sensitivity. But it doesn't need to have such a high specificity because you're going to follow that up with another test anyway. You just want to make sure you're not missing anybody. So on the other hand, for a confirmatory test, you're tolerating, you want a very high specificity so that after that test, if you're labeling somebody as positive, you want to be sure they're positive. And you're willing to do that and tolerate that, you know, have a lower sensitivity on the flip side of it. So you can adapt these things. And this is the same situation here. You can adapt the cutoff based on what you want to do with it. With the surprise question, if you're in luck, it's suitable for one of those two cases. If you're out of luck, it's not really that well suited for either one of them. With the model, it's your choice. Now, obviously, the surprise question is labor-intensive. I think, you know, we're all filling out too many forms already as it is. Do you want to have the physicians fill out yet another form? Or would you say, I'd rather have it automated, which you can do with the model. It's completely automated, no physician time required at all, especially against the background that it gives you the same or even a better predictive power. Why wouldn't you automate it and avoid burdening the physician further? And then lastly, but well, maybe we can use the surprise question to put it in the model and enhance the model, quote-unquote. Well, I hope I've covered that. In my personal opinion, absolutely no. You want to keep the model independent from the physician's opinion at all cost. And if I'm not mistaken, that is my last slide. So with that being said, I want to thank you very much for your attention.